Getting loony about loons. For many people in Maine, the cry of the loon is the sound of the summer. It reminds us of precious vacation days spent on a lake or pond, falling asleep to that distinctive call. Loons are charismatic, large and beautiful, with their distinctive black and white feathers, red eye, and sharp black beak. And who doesn't love the sight of a loon mother swimming with its chick, hitching a ride on her back? I'm Jennifer Rooks. How is Maine's loon population doing? What threats do loons face? As loon lovers look forward to another summer season and another annual loon count, our experts answer your questions about this beloved bird. This program is part of Maine Calling's ongoing coverage of topics that reflect the unique character of Maine. Loons, next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It's a sound that many associate with sitting by a lake in Maine, the mournful wail of a loon. Today, we'll learn more about this iconic Maine bird and what's being done to manage and protect loon populations across the state. Joining me in the studio, Danielle DiOria. She is a wildlife biologist with the Bird Group at Maine's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Susan Gallo is executive director of the Maine Lakes Society and the longtime head of the Maine Loon Count. And James Parukh is an associate professor of biology at St. Joseph's College. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a story to share about a loon encounter somewhere in Maine? Are you concerned about threats to the health of the loon population? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you. Danielle, I suspect there are many people out there very envious of your job, getting to work with Maine's bird population and specifically with loons. Give us some basic facts about loons. What kinds of loons are in Maine? I understand there's more than one kind. What's the kind that we think of as iconic, and what else is there?
Well, we primarily have common loons, which are the ones that that most people associate with Maine and out on our lakes. The bold black and white patterning of those birds as adults, and the red eye that stands out to many people. But we also have red-throated loons that are seen primarily offshore during the winter. And then every now and then we might get a rare bird, like a yellow-billed or something like that. But primarily common loons are our focus.
They look so big. How much does an adult loon weigh?
I believe anywhere between 9 and 15 pounds.
They are big.
Yeah, their bones are very solid compared to other birds, which enables them to dive more efficiently, and that contributes to their weight as well.
Jim, tell me what they're doing right now. Here we are, the beginning of April. Where are the loons? Are they still out in the ocean? Are they in Maine lakes? And actually, maybe I should make the question even broader. I have seen Maine loons out in the ocean during the winter. Do they all just stay around here, or do they go somewhere else?
Hey, that's a great question. Where'd you get that from? So we did a study to try to investigate that question, and we put satellite transmitters inside loons, the inside of their body cavity, and then we were able to use satellites and detect where they moved. And many of them just were offshore here in Maine, and some went even a little further south of Cape Cod, for example. So some of our Maine loons winter just off the coast of Maine, and some probably further south off Massachusetts and maybe even Maryland, for example.
So they don't go very far.
No, they don't.
I've heard, and tell me if this is true, if their nest fails on a lake, they might just head back out to the ocean early.
Yeah, it's very true. They may attempt to re-nest a second time. And if that nest is unsuccessful, they may stay on the freshwater body for a couple of weeks, maybe a month. And then they may end up going to the ocean if there's better foraging there.
Okay, so it's really all about the availability of food.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Susan Gallo, I understand there's an anniversary this year of the loon count?
Well, actually, that was last year.
Oh, okay.
Last year was the 35th
Wow.
Anniversary of Maine Audubon's annual loon count. So that was a big deal, 35 years of data about loon populations.
Give me a sense of the scale. How does it work? It's one day a year, right?
Yeah, it's the third Saturday in July. It happens at 7:30 in the morning. And there are about 1,400 people across the state who participate on about 300 different lakes.
And if anybody wants to get involved, they can?
Yeah, just get in touch with Maine Audubon. I believe it's maineaudubon.org/loons, and you can learn more. Or I'm now with the Maine Lake Society, so I've sort of left loons behind. Not really, because
on the Lake Society.
Yeah, and loons are really important to our organization as well, and I can tell you more about that later. But the count will be happening this summer on that third Saturday in July, and I know Maine Audubon would love to have more volunteers.
So give us some numbers. What do we know about Maine's loon population? How many loons are there in Maine?
Well, it's hard to say for sure. Our count, the Maine Audubon's count, really focuses on the southern half of the state. So if you kind of imagine drawing a line from Rangeley to Calais south, that's where we have a lot. That's where Maine Audubon has a lot of volunteers.
You mean it's hard to get volunteers to all the lakes in Aroostook County?
Yes, many more lakes and many fewer people at that part of the state. But so the southern half of the state is where Maine Audubon focuses their efforts in terms of getting a population estimate. So in that half of the state, the population, as counted by the volunteers, has gone from about fewer than 1,600 in 1983, early 80s, 83, 84, 85, to just over 3,000 in the last few years. So we, and that's based on an estimate. It doesn't matter if there's more volunteers or fewer volunteers. The calculations for the estimate kind of take all that into account. So that's a very real doubling of our adult loon population.
So how does that number, how would you characterize the number in terms of where that puts loons in, what the loon population ought to be?
Well, that's a great question. There isn't really I'm not sure what that number, I don't know if anybody has a target number for what Maine should be. We certainly have all those loons in northern Maine that add to that number of 3,000. We actually believe a lot of the territories in that part of the state, that a lot of those territories are occupied. So loons need a certain acreage of lake, about 100 acres each. A pair needs about 100 acres to make a living and catch enough fish. And so one of the questions that Maine Audubon has been asking is sort of where is the potential for the population to grow? And we don't really know that it can grow that much more.
In pretty good shape.
It is in really good shape. And I think that's in large part to improved, better attitudes. People, I think, realize what loons need. They leave them alone. They stay away. They slow down their boats. I think that plays a huge role in the recovery of the population in the last 35 years.
Well, and that's what we're talking about, the recovery of the population. And Danielle, I wanted to ask you about that. It was a few decades ago pretty bleak times for the loon. Talk about where, sort of the history of where we've come in this generation.
Well, I know right now we consider our loon population pretty robust and doing pretty well, especially when it comes to all the Northeast. Loons are not listed in Maine as endangered, threatened, or even special concern. They are considered a species of greatest conservation need because they're important to Maine. We actually have a high responsibility for the population in the Northeast because
there's so many more in Maine?
Yeah, we probably host about 70 to 75% of the northeastern loon population here in Maine. So we really do have a high responsibility. So I don't have the history from decades ago as to where those numbers were. But I know, like Susan said, they have been climbing a bit over at least the past couple decades. And we feel pretty good about where they are, but I think they still have certain threats that, we want to make sure that we keep those in check as well and that they don't go down again.
Jim, tell us about the life cycle of a loon. If we're lucky enough to be on a lake or pond and we see that mama loon with the chick on in her back, how long until that chick is an adult, a breeding adult?
Yeah, so it takes about 10 to 12 weeks for the chick to eventually gain the ability to fly independently and also just to forage on its own. So for loon chicks, they really rely on their parents quite a bit for food. And probably 4 to 6 weeks, they start switching where they're starting to catch food for themselves independently. But up until about 8, 9 weeks, they still rely a bit on their parents. And they're also developing, you might see them rowing across a lake, for example, developing their wing musculature, muscles, flapping. And then eventually they fly at probably 10, 11, or 12 weeks of age.
And what about when they're considered an adult and a breeding adult? How long does that take?
Yeah, it takes 3 years. So the loons then, the young loons that we have here will migrate oftentimes to marine environments in the ocean, and they'll stay there for a year or potentially even 2 years before returning back to where they were born.
Does that affect conservation efforts that they, you know, it takes a while? Other birds, it's not 3 or 4 years, is it?
Yeah, you're right. So when you think about, sometimes people use the expression reproduce like rabbits. Well, loons are not rabbits, in other words, right? They reproduce slowly, almost every other year before they actually fledge one. And it takes them about 6 or 7 years before they reach reproductive maturity and are even capable of getting a lake in which to breed and find a partner.
All right. If you'd like to ask a question about loons, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Jim, what kind of threats do loons face?
Well, I would say in marine environments, they certainly face like oil threats. Oil pollution would be a concern. During migration, botulism, for example, there's another disease called aspergillosis, a fungal disease. That's a spore that's airborne and everywhere. And if a loon's unhealthy or stressed, it might get this fungus growing inside of it. And then on the breeding grounds, I would think shoreline development, like loss of habitat for to build the nest, for example, would be a concern. Human recreational pressure would be another concern as well. And even potentially lead poisoning, for example.
Mm. And Susan, you mentioned that people, for example, in motorboats now know more than they used to know to leave loons alone. What are the other guidelines can you give people who go to lakes and ponds? I mean, I confess I've kayaked pretty close to a loon and the loon really didn't seem to care. I mean,
yeah, loons are really different in their sort of how well they tolerate disturbance. But the loons really give you the signs. They'll tell you, and you know if they're making a lot of calls, if they're getting all riled up on the water, they'll let you know when you're too close. But the biggest things we can do really is the two big things that come to mind. In terms of the biggest causes of death for loons is lead sinkers. There are laws that prohibit the use of lead sinkers that are an ounce or less, or lead-headed jigs that are 2.5 inches or less in length. And so those have been on the books for a little while now, and we know they're making a difference. We know lots of anglers out there have stopped using lead and have changed over, and the more we can just keep that going, the better off loons will be. And then the other thing would be the other sort of leading cause of death up there, as Jim mentioned, is people another source. It's people and boat trauma. So there's a graduate student, Brooke McDonald, who's been looking into this, and boat trauma is actually really or trauma from a collision with a large object. So mm-hmm. we're making the jump that it's boats, but probably speeding boats, hitting loons is probably the second, right up there with lead sinkers for causes of death.
And you're talking about the lead sinkers. I'm guessing that every decent bait and tackle shop in Maine knows this and doesn't sell them, but folks may have an older lead sinker in their tackle box that...
Yes, I think there's a huge legacy of lead tackle out there because, you know, anglers, if you're a kid, you get your tackle box from your dad or your grandfather, hopefully your grandmother. And so there's a lot of lead out there, old lead out there that we need to deal with and take care of.
Danielle, it looks like you want to jump in. What do you want to add? What can people to help protect loons?
Yeah, I was thinking about the lead issue as well. We've taken a lot of steps, especially with working with Maine Audubon, to kind of update our laws to reflect what we've found in dead loons as far as what's caused their death. So I think that's one of the big ones is the whole Fish Lead Free initiative that got started a few years ago.
Jim, I understand that you have studied the effects of major oil spills on the environment and especially testing loons. Are loons sort of a canary in the coal mine? Are they telling us how clean our environment is?
Well, I would say loons have been thought about as like a bioindicator species, which is just a fancy word for saying they might be like a canary in the coal mine. So for mercury, for example, they may accumulate mercury. They feed high in the food chain. So if there's any contaminant in the environment, it might work up through the food chain. And for example, loons then might concentrate that. So there's potential for sure.
And what do we know about Maine's loons? Do they have high levels of contaminants?
I don't think so far Maine loons have had high level of contaminants for the most part. So they've been fairly healthy and robust.
Okay. We're obviously doing a whole program on loons today because people love loons so much. Susan, you know more than 1,000 volunteers who come out to count them. What do you think it is? What is it about loons that makes people so passionate about them?
Well, I think it's definitely an emotional connection, and people have an experience on a lake that they associate with a loon call. I think the calls are pretty dramatic and really resonate with people, especially those evening calls, the wails that they make at overnight. Really, I think that if you have that experience, especially as a child, that stays with you. And I think they're just so big and dramatic. They're easy to see compared to a lot of our smaller ducks and water birds. So they're charismatic and people connect.
Okay, so we're talking about cries. Before we go to a break, we're going to play three different distinctive loon cries. And I want you all to help us understand what the difference is, that translate loon language for us. So here's the first one. So this is what I think most people refer to when they say the cry of the loon or the wail. What does that mean?
So that's the one I just mentioned about hearing at night. So that's a call you hear at night. It's a communication between pairs. And what's nice about the wail is there's no stress. They're generally not worried about anything. They're not having an interaction with another pair. It's just kind of communication. I'm over here. And then you'll hear another pair answer from a distant lake. So you hear, you can often hear if you're in a lake, in a area with a lot of lakes, you can often hear echoing calls back and forth.
All right. So now another one. Okay. We'll call that one the yodel. Jim, do you know what the yodel means?
Sure. That's given just by the male. And it's usually like a territorial announcement. I'm here. I'm ready to defend this area of the lake from any other loon. And other neighboring loons recognize those very specific calls.
Okay, the last one. I think this is what people, when they use the expression crazy as a loon, are talking about this sound. What does this mean?
So that's the tremolo. And I think of that as communication between individuals. Sometimes they also will emit that when they're stressed a little bit, too. I don't know if you guys have anything to add.
A lot of pair bonding. The males and females will tremolo back and forth to each other.
So that's flirting?
Yeah, I guess it's...
I would add anxiety, though.
Oh.
Yeah, I would also say when you hear that, sometimes if a boat comes too close or some disturbance, you'll hear the pairs tremolo to each other.
All right. Well, we're talking about loons on Maine Calling. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Whipfley MacPage, a firm committed to providing quality accounting, consulting, and tax services. Whipfley.com/Maine. And Colby College, presenting Guillermo Gomez Peña's solo performance, The Most Undocumented Mexican Artist, Tuesday, April 9th, Colby.edu.
Lawrence Bartley spent 27 years behind bars. Now he's out, and he's created a print magazine to distribute back into prisons.
Many of the men on the inside just wish they can just have a glimpse of what the outside is. And I thought it was important to bring that to them.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a former inmate's quest to bring stories to the incarcerated. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's today from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with Pete Buttigieg, the 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who hopes to become the youngest president ever.
the consequences for my generation of the decisions being made right now are enormous. I mean, almost by definition, the longer you're planning to be here, the more you have at stake.
Pete Buttigieg, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Saturday afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are learning all about loons. Joining me today, Susan Gallo, Executive Director of the Maine Lakes Society. James Parouk is an Assistant Professor of Biology at St. Joseph's College. And Danielle Dioria is a Wildlife Biologist with the Bird Group at Maine IF&W. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Mark Pokris. He's a retired wildlife veterinarian who is an associate professor emeritus with Tufts University's Veterinary School, and works with loons in Maine and across the country. Thanks for calling in, Mark, and I understand you're out in the field right now.
Well, I'm getting ready to be in the field. I'm packing the car with all the field equipment. I'll be out in New Hampshire, actually, the next couple of days working with the Loon Preservation Group over there. But everybody you've got on the show is a good friend, and we've worked together for a long time.
Your role as a veterinarian is to look at the health and disease in loons. What are some of the injuries or illnesses that you see, and what do you do about them?
Well, I think that the panel, Danielle and Susan and Jim, have already talked about some of these. We see a lot of trauma. We see boat hits. We see a lot of entanglement in fishing line. We see birds swallowing fishing gear. And, of course, one of the major types of gear they swallow is lead. It's a problem that we've been working on in Maine and across the country for quite a number of years, and I think making some progress. It's slow progress. But one of the things that we're seeing more and more, and again, the group has been talking about, is things that are related to environmental change. You know, we're seeing climate change. We're seeing changes in fisheries, both freshwater fisheries and ocean fisheries, that are affecting animals that live in the ocean and animals that eat fish. And so for the first time in Maine just a few years ago, we saw a tropical disease in a loon. We saw avian malaria that's carried by mosquitoes that killed a loon on Lake Umbagog. Mm. And so it's those kinds of things that we're studying, new parasites, new diseases that may be associated with climate change, that may be associated with the introduction of invasive or exotic species. My role in this, you know, the biologists you've got on there have done a wonderful job in terms of research and environmental education and policy. And my role is to work on the health issues and try and figure out what can we learn from loons that have died or loons that are sick to help improve our ability to rehabilitate loons. There are a number of rehabilitation centers in Maine that work with loons. Center for Wildlife down in Cape Medic primarily, and Avian Haven up in Freedom, I think, are high on the list. And so getting all these people together to try and understand what's going on with loons and to try and see how we can help them more.
You have students you get involved with your research. Is the next generation as passionate about loons as we old folks are?
Well, you know, there was a while there where I was a little pessimistic, but I'll tell you, in working with young students at the moment, high school students, college students, graduate students, I see a tremendous resurgence of environmental interest and dedication. And I think a lot of this is due to organizations like Maine Audubon Society. You know, Susan's been working for many years, state agencies like Danielle's work with IF&W. I think media work on trying to educate the population. And so I'm more optimistic than I might have been 10 years ago that people care more and they know more about these animals. They're more concerned about the environment around them, and they realize we share this environment. And things that are affecting loons out there, whether it's changes in fisheries or changes in diseases or changes in environmental contaminants, are also things that affect us and affect all other species.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for calling in before your field work. That's Mark Pokris, a wildlife veterinarian who works extensively with loons. And then we'll go straight to Andrea, who's calling from Wallagrass. Hi, Andrea. Go ahead.
Hi there. I had the fortunate experience of seeing a group of loons. There were probably 20 loons on Lake Ambachisis outside of Millinocket. And I've never heard anyone address if loons are flock birds or not. And why has that never really been addressed?
Go ahead.
Sure. What time of month did you see those birds?
It was late fall.
Okay, so that's a great observation. And what happens, this has actually been observed fairly often, and I think all of us biologists were looking at each other because this actually is one of the more common questions we get, is in the late fall, late summer, early fall, late summer, it's not uncommon to see 20, 30, 40, or even more loons aggregate. In a sense, essentially flocking. And part of that is now they're freed from parental responsibility. They don't have to spend time with their chicks. They start to move around, get to look at other lakes, territories. They're relaxed. And there also seems to be a transition in their behavior from being really strongly like territorial to that relaxing, and they become more social. And so we see late August a lot of social flocking taking place.
They're empty nesters, literally.
Yes, yes.
I like that. Andrea, thanks so much for calling in with that question. We'll go to John, who's calling from Orland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Well, I want to get back to the younger loons. The tremolo that we hear on Alamoosuc Lake in Orland comes oftentimes when one of the two pairs of eagles, one pair north, the other pair south, take off, and immediately we hear the tremolo. It's like an early warning system. But I'm just wondering whether the demise of baby loons happens more from eagles, or are there other threats like turtles that are a threat to baby loons?
Yeah, this is Susan. I would say there is a huge suite of threats, and my fellow panelists can jump in, but I would start with certainly turtles, mink. There's a lot of egg predators out there like mink. There are big fish that will take loons. There's eagles. You guys want to jump in with some others? Loon chicks just face a huge uphill battle in terms of surviving.
And especially because they nest on the ground, correct?
Right. They're right on the lake shore, so they're susceptible to any predator walking along the lake shore, and I think that's why mink are such a big predator. And also, their lakeside nest is also really susceptible to waves, speedboats. And, you know, if a boat goes by too fast with a big wave, that wake will, you know, can wash the eggs right out of the nest.
Yeah, so just a thought. The caller was following up on the bald eagles. And as bald eagle populations increase, we're noticing an increase in chick predation. So, and I think that's fairly natural. I think these two species have kind of co-evolved with each other. So, but as we have more eagles, I think they do predate on more loon chicks.
John, thanks for your question. A tweet from Betty. As a kid, I was always told that loons eat baby ducks. Is this true?
Not that I'm aware of. Maybe in some extreme situation, but no, they're pretty much, they are fish eaters, and that's their primary diet. They will eat, you know, frogs or crayfish if they need to, but fish are what they're after.
Okay, an email from Gregory. Can two sets of nesting loons share the same territory?
Go ahead.
No, we don't see that, for example. They may be in the same area of a lake, for example, but they're strongly territorial, and they'll defend like almost an imaginary boundary, keeping each other separated from each other.
Do they have a way of delineating their boundary?
I think patrolling is the main way. Letting it know this is my place, for example.
Okay. Do some want a bigger territory than others?
Not necessarily. I think if there's enough prey, that's the main thing they're looking for. If there's enough fish, then they're satisfied.
Okay. We'll go to Sharon, who's calling from Gray. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. Take you off speakerphone. I'm on the shore of Little Sebago.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm sorry. I thought I had lost you.
Go ahead.
And we have a very robust population of loons on Little Sebago. Jim has been out here, actually, with us. We had this past year 9 nests and had a very healthy reproductive season. But we had an experience last summer that was quite extraordinary, and I wanted to share that with you. Many of our birds here on Little Sebago are banded, and we had one loon that had lost one of her leg bands, and we were thinking we knew which loon it was from the past, and were able to capture that loon, remove the middle band that was remaining on the other leg, and with the identification number on that band, we were able to determine that she was in fact a loon that had been banded here on our lake way back in 1997. And she had been previously positively identified through that band with two different mates in two different territories within the lake. And this summer was her third mate in her third territory, and she did reproduce once again. So that was a very fortunate event, and we'll be watching closely for her to come back next summer. And then I wanted to speak just a little bit to one of the previous comments. I myself recovered two chicks on the lake, not last summer, but the previous summer. And both of those chicks had been observed by bystanders on the shore being killed by non-parent adults. So it wasn't, it was hard. It was, we were happy to know that they were killed through their own natural environment and not from anything that our boaters or, you know, residents had done. So not that we were happy that we lost two chicks, but we were happy that we lost them through nature and not through human intervention.
Well, Sharon, thanks so much for calling and sharing. Amazing that, is that amazing to you, Jim, that one loon was breeding for so many years?
Yeah, so we have some data that show that adult loons live to be 30 years. So this loon here was close to like 25 years. And we've also noticed that they typically last with one pair for 5, 6, or 7 years, and then it's not uncommon to have multiple partners over a lifetime.
All right. So, well, Sharon, thanks for your call. An email from Betty. I love watching loons bobbing under the water. I'm always amazed at the distance they travel. Is this purely for feeding, and how long can they stay submerged?
Yeah, so it's not uncommon for them to go over 100 yards underwater.
Right.
And in terms of depth, I received a video from a fisherman, and the net was placed at 200 feet below the surface. And so we know loons can dive up to 200 feet, which is pretty impressive.
And is it just to feed, or do they do it for fun?
No, I don't think they would do it for fun. That's like somebody, like a runner, going out running 20 miles for fun. There's a few of those.
But well, some of them do it.
I know they do. That's not me. But so for loons, I think for the most part, if the water is very deep in an area, they might be going for a specific fish targeted down at the bottom of the lake. But for the most part, real shallow dives.
Okay. An email from Sherry. Are there studies regarding the effects of fireworks on loons and other wildlife? I've noticed loons are much more vocal when people are shooting off fireworks in the summer. Also, how does fireworks debris affect water quality?
Well, Maine Audubon has been interested in this question for a long time, and unfortunately, we haven't thought of a good way to answer it. So, there's definitely an impact. Anyone who watches a pair of loons and during a fireworks display can tell most loons are pretty agitated. But the question is quantifying that. How can we quantify that disturbance actually, you know, that there's a direct linkage between the disturbance and the productivity of the loon? There's, unfortunately, the water quality data is not great out there. Just most lakes are so big, and the quantities in terms of the debris and the chemicals and in the fireworks are so small that it's hard to measure any difference at all. I do feel that with more fireworks on the lakes, with the change in regulations a couple years ago, that we eventually, I think, we'll get to a place where we can either gather more data or hopefully do something about it, because I think it's a big disturbance for loons in Maine in the summer.
Yeah, I was just going to add that, you know, during those fireworks displays, there's also more people out on the lake in their boats. And that traffic, that additional traffic at a time when most of our loons have chicks, can be detrimental to those loons, too.
All right. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We're talking about loons. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries, using a collaborative approach to securing a fishing future in the Gulf of Maine. Saltwater, fresh thinking. And Maine Farmland Trust, celebrating 20 years of growing the future for farming. Share your stories and get involved at MaineFarmlandTrust20th.org.
Here's what New Hampshire's Republican governor sounds like now when you ask him about climate change.
Man-made emissions have a part to play in climate change. Yes, fact, done. Let's move on.
But his politically powerful family hasn't always seen it that way. On Next from the New England News Collaborative, tracing the history of the GOP and climate. Also, the politics of race and legalized weed.
Rich white people are making money off of this when poor black people have been affected by this.
Please join us.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Picture a subway car. There's a woman and she's looking at her phone and she starts laughing.
If you want people to laugh, you get them laughing and then you keep them going.
How do ideas, disease, humans, and even laughter spread? Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Wednesday evening at 11 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Maine's iconic loons. Joining us today, James Parrouk, professor with St. Joseph's College, Danielle Dioria, wildlife biologist with Maine IF&W, and Susan Gallo with Maine Lakes Society. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have a tweet from Robert. Our cottage is on the Damariscotta River, 8 miles upstream from the ocean. We were surprised that we have nesting loons there on saltwater with some breeding success. Why aren't these birds on freshwater?
Great question. I think if there's enough prey available, food for them, and the water level doesn't fluctuate much, it might actually work for them. So that's a great call-in.
We'll go to Carol calling from Manchester. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Hi there. We've had the good fortune of living on Corpus Christi for a number of years, and we've had a chance to witness a number of different loon behaviors. But we did see something once that I have not heard an explanation for, and I hope your guests can help me understand it. We were returning to our dock, and we're just basically floating in. The sun was shining down through in such a way that we could see into the water. And there were, I believe, 3 loons swimming underwater in a very tight circle, around and around and around at quite a good rate of speed. And eventually they swam off. But I wondered what that behavior might be about.
Our guests are looking at each other and consulting as you're talking.
Well, they do fish cooperatively in the summertime, and you'll see 2 or 3. But usually, if they'll swim in circles around a small school of fish, and they'll work together to keep that, you know, to keep a school together and then feed. But I don't know if you guys have other.
Well, it almost seems like too. There may have been some chasing involved as well. If there were like long dives, I wonder if there was some chasing involved.
Well, Carol, you saw something special. Thanks for calling in. Lori says in an email, I live on a lake in Greenwood, and I'm always amazed that the loons know exactly when the ice has melted and can come back to the lake. Each year, the timing's different. It seems they arrive on the exact day the ice is gone. How do they know when to move back? Do they do patrols?
Actually, they do. I've witnessed loons fly over the pond near my house. Early morning, they'll be most likely a male kind of circling the pond, checking it out, but it's still frozen. So they do repeat visits to see what the status is. And then as soon as it's open, they are there.
Frank on Facebook says, are the loons I see in offshore waters different from lake loons? And the answer is no, right? Mm-hmm. They're the same loons, just moving back and forth looking for fish, right?
Correct.
Okay, terrific. We'll go to Howard also calling from Manchester. Hi, Howard. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. So I heard earlier in the show, I just sat down. I typically always listen. and someone was saying that loons will not eat, or I don't know if it was eat or attack, baby ducks. But we camp every year on Lake Pemaquid, and 2 years ago, and even last year, we witnessed in a cove, we always camp in the same cove, all of a sudden there was this giant ruckus, and there was a mother with several baby ducklings, and there was a lady that ran to out on her wharf with an oar, trying to push away a loon that was attacking the baby ducks. And we witnessed that two or three times over the same period of week camping, and witnessed a similar event, except on our side of the cove last year.
Wow.
And so I don't know what's precipitating that loon. I mean, we always thought the loons were the most peaceful and, you know, just the, you know, most lovable things going. And then we see them being very aggressive, and the mother trying to protect the baby ducks. And, you know, of course, we're out there trying to keep the loons from also, you know, with an oar, not touching anything, but just trying to keep the loon away from the mother and her baby ducks. And
sure,
so
big wildlife experience,
that.
Huh?
Yeah, I was thinking of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, two different personalities. So during the spring, loons are highly territorial, extremely aggressive. So anything swimming in their territory on the surface, they're going to come investigate, and they might even feel threatened. So I've seen them actually, I have seen them kill ducks before. It's not like it's that uncommon. So, but they're not using it for food, but they're just defending a space. They'll defend against other loons. They'll protect territories. And then this is more shocking and a little nervous to introduce this, right? But loons will kill other loons sometimes during the spring. They will dive underneath and come up under their sternum full speed and ram it. Mark Pokers has some great data looking at kind of the chest bone, and you can see there's almost like the bill punctures right through it. So
wow.
That happens on occasion. So that tells you how feisty and aggressive they can be at times.
Howard, thanks for your call. We'll move up to John, who's calling from Trenton. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. I just happen to be in a loon monitoring group on NDI. And we monitor nesting loons in about 7 nesting sites on the island, various lakes on the island. We have one pair of loons that nest right next to Echo Lake Beach, which is a very public beach in the national park. And it's we now have a raft that they nest on, but it's probably within 50 yards of this very public swimming area. So it's an ideal opportunity just to educate people about loons. We have binoculars and other equipment on a table, and we talk about loons to the people that are at the park, at the beach, and just try to educate them and tell them that they shouldn't swim out to the raft and they should stay away from loon chicks and things like that. So that's my comment.
John, thanks for calling in. Sounds like a great, beautiful spot. We're going to go to Callie calling from Millinocket. Hi, Callie. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I am enjoying the show as I'm driving up north, and I was reminded of a time this past year where I was in Death Valley, California, visiting my brother who works for the Nature Conservancy and is a bird specialist. And we were driving down the highway, and suddenly I noticed there was a large dead bird on the side of the road, and we stopped, and it turns out it was a loon. And it was alarming because it was in the middle of Death Valley, and I just had no concept of loons being in the desert, coming from northern Maine. And I believe what they discovered, or what they thought was the situation, was that it maybe was a juvenile who had landed during migration or something, and then had a difficult time taking back off because it was not water but a highway that he had landed on. And I was just curious if anybody had any thoughts on that. But the interesting thing to me was the size of their lower body in against other birds, their large lower body, and any comments that they may have on that.
Yeah, and interesting too, Jim, because you've said that most of the loons here in Maine don't migrate, but there are loons that do migrate.
Oh, absolutely. We think of birds like interior Midwest, Manitoba, Saskatchewan. They might fly 2,000 or more miles to the Gulf of Mexico, off Southern California coast, into the Baja Peninsula, for example. And I have read about occasions where loons have been actually been observed in Death Valley. So the caller, I've heard this before, and whether it was whether they were fooled, whether they were tired, they landed and then couldn't get up, but they were probably migrating, you know, maybe from Montana or someplace like that across.
Right. The loons in other parts of the state don't have an ocean coast to go to. They have to go farther to find it. Thanks, Kelly, for calling. We're going to go to Robert in Portland. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer and guests. I had a very blessed experience in August 2012, at the end of August into September. For 9 days, I canoed the entire Allegash with two other people. We had two canoes and slept out every night in my tent. And one night at about 2-3 in the morning, the wind sounded like a locomotive over your head to a degree, and the lots of movement among trees and stuff. And I'm lying there. I woke up from this commotion with the wind, and I heard loons. It's very hard to describe. You can hear I'm talking more slowly just thinking about it. It is the call of Maine to me, the Maine woods, I should say. And it was such a magical experience. I urge people to, you know, if you're still able to get out camping by water. Of course, this was on the Allegash River. And just behold the sound of the Maine woods. It was a treasure.
Oh, Robert, thanks so much for calling in. You know, we had a caller earlier from Little Sebago. You don't really have to go that far from the population areas in Maine to find loons, do you?
No, that's one of the great things. Maine Audubon gets calls every summer from people who, you know, they want to come to Maine to see a loon. And the nice thing is you can say almost anywhere, really, really a high percentage of our lakes have loons.
Robert, thanks for your call. A tweet from Neil. Is there any correlation between the increase in loon population and the stocking of our Maine rivers with farm-raised fish? Are there studies that stocked rivers or other bodies of water are attracting loons more than ones that are not?
I would say there most likely isn't. As far as, you know, we haven't done anything to increase our stocking in relation to the population of loons. I know some fishermen don't appreciate loons on the same lakes that they fish, but there's plenty of fish to go around, really.
I was going to ask that. You say plenty of fish to go around. Do we have a sense of how much a loon eats? Do we know that, Professor?
Well, probably close to a third of its body weight per day. So like a quarter to a third of its body weight per day.
So if it's a 20-pound loon?
Well, I would say probably a 10-pound loon, let's say.
A 10-pound loon?
So probably eats, you know, 3.5 pounds of fish a day.
That's a lot.
That's a fair amount, yes.
Imagine if somebody our size ate 2.5 to 3 pounds of fish a day. We'd think that was a lot. That's amazing. You know, before we go, I know, Susan, you wanted to talk a little bit about what we can all do to protect the loons if we're lucky enough to have some nearby.
Yeah, we talked briefly about fish lead free, but I just wanted to mention a couple other things. Invasive aquatic plants are really detrimental to loons. Maine is really lucky to have, you know, invasives, infestations few and far between, but, you know, cleaning your boat when you're moving your boat around, inspecting your under your boat, making sure you're not carrying plant materials is really important. And then the other one is pollution and runoff. So Maine Lake Society has a program called Lake Smart. We actually have a component of that program called Loon Smart, which is geared toward improving habitat and survival for loon chicks. And at the program itself is designed for pollution reduction. So please check in at MaineLakeSociety.org for more information about that.
Well, thank you all for being here all on Maine Calling on this Friday to talk about Maine's iconic aquatic bird, the loon. The voice you just heard, Susan Gallo, Executive Director of Maine Lakes Society and the longtime head of the Maine Loon Count. Also here, Daniel Dioria, wildlife biologist with the Bird Group at Maine's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and James Parouk, associate professor of biology at St. Joseph's College. Lucy Suchek ran the board today, and Isaac Merson took your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Today's show was part of Maine Calling's ongoing coverage of topics that reflect the unique character of Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.